Right over the hill from the Albion Castle in the Bayview neighborhood of San Francisco, I'm Schmitty, and this is Talkin' Schmidt. Today on the show is legendary vert skater Jordan Richter. Jordan was in the best skate video of all time. He placed top 10 in street, mini, vert, and even freestyle at the 92AM Finals in Atlanta. And today he's in Fremont teaching kids all about skateboarding. He spent some time with meditation, but says what really gives focus is fasting.
What has been the most, I think, life-changing for me has been probably been fasting. You'll be agitated at first, but the more you practice it, then it'll start breaking you down and you become more humble and you become more self-reflective. So fasting cools that fire down. The best sessions I've ever had was when I was fasting. I did a maple syrup fast. I think Cab and Christian were doing it too for a while, but it's water, lemon, maple syrup, and cayenne pepper. I did that for 40 days. But I learned kickflip nose wheelies in the pool then, in Cunningham, out of the shallow into the deep. And I did that on the fast because of the clarity and the energy that I had.
Also, I really need to give a big shout out to Matt D and the Deluxe SF Bros, who recently started carrying the Schmidt hats and beanies. Give them a visit at 1831 Market Street and tell them I sent you. This is episode 37, and as I've mentioned, I'll be getting interviewed for episode 50. Please submit any questions you'd like included in the interview to talkinschmidt@gmail.com. That's talkinschmidt@gmail.com. You can also visit our website at talkinschmidt.com. I gotta give a special thank you to Steve Martin at Nasty Little Man for helping me be a part of San Francisco history over the weekend, where Metallica played the first ever event at the brand new Chase Arena with the San Francisco Symphony. Truly felt very special getting to be there for all that. Pretty amazing. And the venue, so far, I'm backing it. Anyway, enough of all that. Let's get on with the show.
This is Jordan Richter, and you're listening to Talking Schmidt. Here we go again.
It's cool. Like, tonight is the night.
Just give it the old college try right here.
Oh, big dog's in.
What do you think, Schmitty?
96 times, Schmitty.
Thanks, Schmitty.
We on? Schmitty?
Talking Schmidt.
He's so fucking busy.
He shit my pants, lad.
Your Rolodex is fucking deep.
Are you ready?
Come on, Schmidt.
Let's hear it for Greg Smith.
Yeah! Hello, everybody. We are here at Central Park in Fremont. We're at the skate park, and I have none other than Jordan Richter here with us. How are ya?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm good, man. I'm stoked right now. I'm hyped that this has actually came. We've been talking a little bit back and forth, and we made it happen today. I'm hyped.
I'm honored, man. Thanks.
Yeah. I usually start with, like, you know, some background stuff, like where you were born.
Okay. I was born in Miami, Florida, in a place called Coconut Grove. Pretty much a tourist spot now. It's like in Dade County. And I was born in Mount Sinai Hospital. And it's basically grew up on the Miami Beach.
Okay.
Yeah.
And were you raised there or did you?
I moved from there. I lived there for 10 years. I moved from there when I was 10 to San Diego.
Okay. Yeah. So when did you get into skateboarding?
Probably about 6 months after I got to California.
Okay.
Yeah.
San Diego.
I was an avid tennis player prior.
Oh, yeah. True or false, you almost went pro.
No, false. Not even close. Maybe I could have if I had the money to go to tennis camp.
Yeah. Pete told me that one that you were done. Do you remember, like, getting the bug, though? Like, what you saw or how you ended up getting your first skateboard?
Yeah, I was coming home from school one day and I came upon some guys skating in their parking lot, and they had built their own quarter pipe with, like, it was like a 4 foot high quarter pipe. They went to vert and had pool coping, or had tiles on it with PVC coping, and they were, you know, kick turning on it and just skating around. And I was at a time in my life where we had a lot of challenges in the home, so I was, I guess, actively looking for something that I could kind of find to keep myself busy and do. And skateboarding looked like that would be the thing I could get into.
What was your first skateboard?
My first skateboard, I think my mom bought me, was a Toys R Us board. Like, it was just one of those plastic. It was a fiberglass board. It was like with transparent wheels and the bearings. You know, it had that really loud. They didn't have really any seals in it. It was just
right.
I think I got a good few months out of that, and then continued skating and found out that what a real skateboard would be. And then my mom took me to La Jolla Surf Systems, which is a surf shop down in La Jolla, and picked up my first quote unquote real skateboard, which is a G&S board, and it was like, had a dog on it, or like a wolf with barbed wire. It was a complete. So I bought it off the rack.
So it's kind of like a team board.
Yeah, it was like, we'd be probably compared to like a Price Point Powell board now.
Sure. Yeah. And approximately what year was that?
It was 84.
84.
Yeah.
Nice. And so then it just blew up from there. You started skating, meeting people.
Yeah, well, I lived in University City, and actually me and both Peter Hewitt lived in University City. I lived on the north side of the canyon, and he lived on the south side of the canyon. And in the canyon itself was a ramp called the Canyon Ramp.
Ah.
That a bunch of Hessians, and I think even Pete's brother, if I'm not mistaken, had a hand in maybe building it a little bit.
Uh-huh.
His brother, Paul. The guy that I learned how to skateboard from, his house was overlooking that canyon. So I could see from the actual, where the quarter pipe was situated, I could see the canyon ramped also down there. So naturally, after going there all the time after school, I eventually found my way down to the canyon ramp, and that's where I met Paul, and eventually I met Peter. And then Peter had a half pipe in his yard.
Oh,
so it was interesting. It was like the quarter pipe was at the north side, and the canyon ramp was in the middle, and then Peter's was on the, so we had a little trifecta of ramps all at one time, which is interesting.
Nice. So was Pete already kind of
Peter was
good,
Peter was already good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pete was doing like thrusters out of the ramp, like out of his, the ramp was like 5.5-6 feet tall with like 6.5 foot transition. Huh. It went to vert, basically.
Like right to vert?
It went right to vert.
PVC or
super
metal?
Super quick. I think it was black PVC half cut.
Okay.
Yeah. And he was doing thrusters. He did frontside 540s out or like off the lip.
Oh, wow.
And, I mean, he was, now I don't know if he was doing them necessarily then. I know Pete was skating a little bit longer than I was. He uh-huh. started before me, probably, I want to say maybe a year or so before me. Pete's brother was a skateboarder first, I believe. And then we had Eddie Alioto, and we had Adrian Shetterly, and we had other locals in the University City area that were. Eddie Alioto was also really dope.
Yeah. He's
still a great skateboarder. Uh-huh. Great guy.
We spent time with him on the Big Island. We went out there for 13 days and skated with him in backyard mm-hmm. pool and ramps and
yeah.
got to know him pretty well. It was really fun. So those were the guys that you kind of got better into skateboarding more? And
at first, yeah.
What was your first sponsor? How did that happen?
Technically, yeah, my first sponsor was like Del Mar Skate Ranch. Adrian Demain was giving me, he was flowing me Powell boards.
Uh-huh.
Wasn't really like a sponsor, obviously directly through Powell, but it was my first experience with getting something free from the industry or from a pro. So Adrian would, you know, gift me a board or a set of wheels. After I started entering contests and getting more involved in kind of following the castle circuit, I think my first, then it was Dogtown for a little, well, it was Dogtown through Tim Romero. We were talking a little bit. Like, I mean, when we say talking, meaning they're like considering maybe putting me on.
Uh-huh.
I got a board through Tim as well. But eventually, like my first real sponsor was Santa Cruz.
Okay.
Through Jason Jesse.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think Jason was the one who got me on.
Oh, yeah. Sick. Yeah. You were skating with him at Del Mar?
No, I was skating with him at Del Mar, but I don't know if he took notice of me then, but at McGill's was when we would, you know, get to know each other or skate together.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Did you skate Fallbrook back then?
A little bit, but I was during the time of when Fallbrook was alive, busy, with sessions, I think I was not skating at that time. I think it took like a year off. And then I think I just stayed mostly at McGill's.
Yeah.
Didn't really go to Fallbrook. Yeah. I'd skate sometimes, but not, yeah.
Were there Sponsor Me tapes or any of that stuff back then? Or was it just word of mouth through the guys?
No Sponsor Me tapes. There was, the contests, ironically, were like the big kind of deciding factor. Like if you were doing good in contests, then you started to kind of get a name for yourself.
Okay.
And I guess I was doing good in contests, so that helped.
Right.
But I was also skating a lot with all these guys too.
Uh-huh.
And so there was only a handful of us that were, you know, really skating a lot of vert at the time, and a combination of the contests and probably the people you knew that you were skating with.
Sure. Know. Did you you have clips in any of those early?
Yeah, I had some stuff in Reason for Living.
Reason for Living?
Yeah.
Was that your first?
That was my first. Well, it had Strange Notes. Strange Notes, we had like little 1 minute clips.
Uh-huh.
1 minute, like, yeah. Reason for Living was probably my first real like skateboard part.
Rad. That was a good video.
It was a good video.
Yeah. Sick. From there, what happened? Was the next stop Blind, or was
at that time I was living with Danny Way in Fallbrook, like in the middle of nowhere. And Danny had this mini ramp like creation. And Danny at the time, I was with Santa Cruz. They were taking care of me, you know. They sent me to contests and they're giving me stuff. But I don't know, maybe it was just I felt disconnected from the rest of like the team, or never really felt connected in that way. Well, I think what it was is I was hanging out with Danny and the other quote unquote cool guys, and I wanted to like probably fit in. I think what happened is Danny moved on to, I think Mike Trinansky was starting, I think Plan B, if I'm not mistaken. And then he moved over to, or no, I can't remember. It was either Plan B or H Street. It was a little bit of a blur there. But Danny, you know, the story goes is that like Mark already knew a little bit about me through at McGill Skate Park.
Okay.
I've skated with Mark a little bit there. I mean, we definitely like knew a little bit of it. And then I was winning contests at the time as an AM, whatever that means.
Mm.
And I was getting a little bit of a name for myself, and I was living with Danny. And so Danny, I think, wanted to move on to something different with Plan B or H Street. I can't remember. But, and then I think he, in exchange, basically, I wanted to get on Blind. I asked him, you know, hey, you know, what do you think about me riding for Blind? So he's like, I'll see what I, you know, I'll talk to Rocco or I'll talk to Mark. I don't remember who he talked to, but anyways, I found myself getting hooked up with them and riding. And then Megan Baltimore drove out to Danny's house and moved me out to LA. So I moved in with Jay Lee.
Oh.
In a loft in downtown LA for about a year or so. And that was interesting to say the least. And then I started skating along a street, and that's kind of how my kind of street-ish part of my career started to get underway.
Skating with Jason.
Was the influence with Jason. Yeah.
What year was that about?
Mid 90, 91.
Okay.
91, 92.
Is that right when you guys started filming for the Video Days?
No, we filmed for Video Days, I think, even before then.
Oh.
I'm sorry. We were filmed a little bit before then, and then we finished the filming when I moved up there. We did some filming in San Diego when I was living in San Diego.
Uh-huh.
And I think we completed the filming like at Christian's Ramp in Hollywood.
Oh, sick.
In the WC Fields house.
I remember.
And so I finished off the filming in there, you know, up there. It was only a handful of filming sessions, by the way. It wasn't like an extensive like filming sessions. With Spike Film, I've probably filmed a total of like 5-6 times.
And what was that like? Was it just like we're going skating, he's gonna film, or was it kind of pressure like, hey, we gotta get some shit today because Spike's coming, or like?
No, it was pretty easy going. You know, Mark was always so maybe the pressure probably came more from like my other teammates. They wouldn't say anything, but I would feel like I was the vert guy, so
right.
I felt out of place already. And then Rudy and Guy were just, you know, super gnarly skateboarders. But they never really like, I mean, Rudy was, you know, cordial with me. And Guy didn't really feel like ever really liked me. That's just the truth. Sorry, Guy. Which is okay. But there was always this weird like kind of thing. So naturally, I probably felt a little bit pressured to perform. I don't know. I didn't care as much as some of the other guys did. Maybe I should have. So I didn't really have a filmer or anything. It was just like when Spike came, I would film. And naturally, I wanted to impress them and wanted to come up with something that was going to be good and right. worthy. But it wasn't any like pressure from, definitely not from Mark's side.
Uh-huh.
Mark was always right, just kind of whatever, easy come, easy go. But he's Mark, so you want to naturally, you know, sure. make him happy.
Did you build a pretty good relationship with him? Did you guys hang out a bunch back then?
I didn't hang out with Mark that much. I did get some time with him, like at his house, and did get to spend some time. Did a little traveling. I will say though, out of all of them, like Mark always struck me to be the most, and they're all, you know, good guys in their own right. Jason and me were very close. We're not close anymore. But I believe he's a good guy. Obviously, Mark, super awkward and, you know, uh-huh. eclectic guy, but. But at the end of the day, like his heart is a really good person.
And then, how did like the skit part work? Were you guys all done, and then Spike's like, "We got to tie it all together, drive the car." Like, how did all that stuff happen?
If my memory serves me right, it was they bought the car, obviously for the whole gig, and I don't know where they found it, how they came up with it.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know whose idea it was to actually go. I don't know if it was Spike's idea or Mark's. It may have been something they came up with together.
Yeah.
But basically, we drove to Mexico and we drove over the border and we just searched for a place that would be, you know, a low visibility place where we can actually drive it off a cliff.
Uh-huh.
And so the way that happened was like Mark kind of jerry-rigged the gas up to where like it would accelerate when he... So he ghost-rided it, but he may have dropped a brick.
Put a brick on it or something?
On the gas pedal.
Right.
And then just let it just accelerate off the end.
We get one take.
Yeah, what's that?
One take only.
And now, you know, the idea was obviously to like, you know, that we died in the end of the video.
Yeah.
But not before getting, you know, completely drunk and underage drinking and getting smashed with tequila. Awesome. I was drinking real beer at the time.
Yeah.
And I had a lot of zits. Man, I had a lot of zits. And that's the thing, you know, I will say is like at that point, this is fun fact, is that I remember watching the video, besides having the most fast forwarded video part, which people make that joke. I think it's ironic because most people say that joke are people who usually don't skate vert.
Yeah.
Are people who haven't dropped in a vert ramp.
Uh-huh.
And people who, you know, I'm not saying out of arrogance, but probably couldn't do, you know, you'd have to, I guess, skate vert to appreciate some of the stuff.
Right.
But I remember watching, sitting down with like Javante and like Mike Carroll and all these guys. And people have told this story before. My face showed up drinking the alcohol, drinking the beer or whatever. And all my zits showed up and everyone was like, whoa, you know, like making me feel extra bad, you know, which was really traumatizing for a little kid at the time. It's like, you guys are freaking... Like, you guys are jerks, man.
Uh-huh.
So, it was like, you know, it was either the fast-forwarding part or the zip. But now I look back and laugh at it. I'm just like, it was kind of funny.
Did you have any input in the song? My War, well, right?
That's the thing is, I think I was a Black Flag fan at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I was too much of a fan of that song, per se.
Uh-huh.
But again... With Mark, it's like, I remember Mark had the video where it was like just before it was going to be, probably a short while before it was actually, final edits were done and it was going to be released. And the music was being added. And Mark was, I remember being in the editing room with Mark and was sitting down in front of the computer. He's like, dude, do you like this? It's exactly like that. He's like, dude, Jordan, do you like this? And I was like, yeah, sure, Mark. Like, whatever you want, man. I felt always compelled to like, probably because of the respect I had for Mark and,
mm-hmm.
As a kid, obviously, I look up to him in that way, in awe of Mark Gonzalez. So the song was a little bit of me obviously liking Black Flag and probably a little bit of me following what was suggested by Mark.
Black. come. Come on.
I'm sure there was some rhyme and reason behind my war, you know, because it was at the time, maybe Mark looked at it from like a, and I'm only assuming this, but maybe looked at it like, you know, this dysfunctional kid who's like skating vert and he's, that's all he does. And it's just like, this is his kind of his war, I guess. I don't know. Maybe that was like a message. Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I only say that because Mark has always been really thoughtful in the what he releases.
Absolutely.
So I don't know if that was his aim or whatever, but. Because he knew my parents. Oh. I mean, he knew that of my situation, that my mom and dad were having massive drug problems at home, and I had my own challenges at home. So that may have been like his, from his like outlook on it, like, you know, who knows? But this is my own assumption.
Did you know at the time how special that whole situation was?
No, I didn't at all.
Did you think any of the guys did, or was it just kind of like...
Well, no, so let me take that back. I knew that Mark was special.
Uh-huh.
Of course, Jason, I knew it was the best team to be on.
Uh-huh.
In my own mind.
Yeah.
I knew it was like, it was the coolest thing. No doubt about it. It was the best team at the time. As far as like the credibility it brought being on Blind and who they were.
Right.
And what they brought to skateboarding. But the impact of the video itself and how janky it was and how like grainy and kind of crappy the quality was, when it was released, then it clicked. When it was being made, no. But Mark's part was the definitive, like, that was, like, hands down. Like, when he opens up and he's carving around to, jazz. I don't know if it was Miles Davis. But yeah, the jazz riff.
Uh-huh.
Where it's just completely different than you've ever experienced in a skateboard video.
Yeah.
There's never been jazz used. There's never been this kind of free-flowing, surfy, you know, middle finger to everyone. It was the first real video that Mark, I think, maybe had total creative control over.
Uh-huh.
Since he left Vision. And so it was everything you'd want to see from, and you saw Mark's hand in it all. And Spike is extremely talented, obviously. He's a huge, you know, influence of a lot of the production.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, when it was out, and you can see the kind of momentum building. But beforehand, no, I didn't.
I mean, that's pretty much anybody who skated that long's favorite video. If you ask somebody that skated in that era, yeah, that's their
besides
favorite
my part.
I don't know about that. I never fast forwarded. I heard about the vert button way later in life because I grew up on vert skating, so it didn't even make sense to me that you would fast forward vert.
That's all good. Mark Johnson, you know, props to Mark. He posted that video, my video part, like about a year ago, and with the middle finger, he's like, you know, F all you guys, man.
Yeah.
So I was stoked on that. It was validating to see guys later on supporting.
Well, the obvious thing is that kids, well, nowadays there's skate parks everywhere, but at a time kids didn't have access to vert as much, you know, so you could walk out the door, skate street, but to have a vert ramp, you have to have it in.
Yeah, and there was an elitist mentality amongst some of the street skaters where a lot of these ideas spawned from. So you had like, and Mike Carroll is a good friend of mine. And Mike actually never really was like played a role so much as like some of the other guys. But you had like Guy and you had Tim Gavin and you had some of the elitist folks in the street scene that were seemed to be the loudest, you know, ones that would bark at my part and to kind of ridicule and laugh at it. And, you know, Guy eventually, you know, could ride vert and such. But, you know, I don't know what their aim was or what they were trying to get at, but I guess it was just, it just probably seemed out of place from a vert part. And the music, I think the song, I always say that maybe if it was a different song that was more, less intrusive on your ears and your space,
right,
maybe it would have been a little, you know, a little bit differently received. But I don't care. I mean, I'm honored to be a part of the whole thing. It's really cool to look back and be able to show your kids that. So
yeah, that's amazing. Was there a premiere for that back then, or did they not have premieres?
Dude, was there a premiere? Shoot, I can't remember.
Uh-huh.
There was a premiere, I think. I want to say yes, but dude, I don't remember.
Don't really remember.
I should remember, but I don't.
I remember in, I think it was 1992, Phil Shao and I drove to the AM Finals in Atlanta at the Skate Zone.
Yeah.
And I think you got top three in all three things, and you might have won two of them. I think you won the mini ramp, got second invert maybe.
I think I got third invert. I think Colin won. I won the mini ramp contest.
Yeah.
I think Costin got like second. I don't think I got top three. I think I might have got like fifth or sixth or seventh, or I can't remember, in the street. And I got 10th in freestyle. So I placed them all.
That's what, okay.
I brought out the primo slide then. We learned proper primo slides on this.
So as far as anybody, like whatever their opinion is, you're a very diverse skateboarder. That was my point.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Like, yeah. And you had street tricks in your part in the blind video when a lot of vert skaters stopped skating because of street. I mean, we all know the Gator story and how that kind of affected his life.
It's heavy,
and,
man.
And different people. But
I've got a Gator story, by the way.
Yeah. Did you? You knew Gator, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. We skated. I mean, I knew him. Yeah, we skated together, and we skated Del Mar. We skated McGill's. I've never seen anyone on a skateboard. Like, and this is, sounds super cliche and probably corny, but I've never seen anyone on a skateboard with that much like energy and like fury. Super gnarly. Such a tragic end, man. Such an unfortunate end. You know, not for him. I mean, I think that he deserves everything he got, but for the family, you know, that was affected by it. I had a thing that happened with Gator, and I think it was myself and a couple of the locals. It was 2 weeks before he turned himself in. He was evangelical Christian, so he's very, you know, outspoken, and he wanted to share his faith with everyone. And at the time, as kids, like, we didn't understand all that. So we kind of like, you know, that was around the time where the MC Hammer song came out, We Have to Pray. So I started to be the a-hole kid I am and started singing that song, not knowing his mental state at the time, that he was actually like, just committed a murder. So he was a loose cannon at that time, and I was at the sideline on the side of the vert ramp. I remember that very vividly, because it was scary. I was like, we have to pray. I just did the whole lyric, you know, rundown, and then he like, I went up on the vert ramp to drop in, and he literally walked up and did the, you know, and pulled a, you know, you pull a punch back, but he did that with his board. Like, he went to like strike me with his board, and then he like, you know, pulled himself back. But I could see that it was like, that was possible for him to do that.
Yeah.
And then later on, we found out that he turned himself in, and I was like, whoa, that was gnarly. Like, there's a lot of unfortunate, tragic stories like that.
Where, yeah, absolutely.
You know, people just...
Jason, Jesse, he told me that I think right around that same time, like it was definitely after the murder had happened, they were skating vert, and he was pushing his buttons or whatever. I don't know what he was doing. And they almost like started fighting. And Jason was like, fuck, I guess I'm going to have to fight Gator right now. And he's like, Dan Sturt grabbed him. And he's like, that dude will kill you. Get out of here right now. And he's like, damn, he might have saved my life.
I love Dan, man. I spent a lot of time with Dan. Come to think of it, he was like a big mentor for me. And he pushed me to do stuff when no one else would, you know.
Right.
I learned a lot of stuff when I would shoot with Dan.
Rad.
I would land stuff. Him and Sin, there was another guy named Sin, Sanisha, who was the team manager for Airwalk.
Right.
When him and Dan got together, they did all those old like spoof Airwalk ads.
Yeah.
You remember?
Uh-huh.
That was really cool.
Do you have a photo that you shot back then that kind of sticks out as one of your favorite?
Yeah. Dan shot it. It was a back 78 nose grind on a handrail. It was an Airwalk ad.
Oh, rad.
In 1989.
Nice.
Somehow it looks like I'm on top of the rail, which it didn't seem like I was on top of it, but he did some magic with it and made it look like I'm on top.
How cool.
But yeah.
You were still on Blind after the video came out, right? Yeah. Like we got to get into the story about you going to Europe.
Of course. Fire away.
Yeah. Was that kind of like, what year was that?
So that
like,
came later.
Like 94?
That came later. No, that was 94. I was on New Deal when I was in Europe.
Oh, okay.
I got let go kind of Blind. I knew I was going to get let go and I quit, but I probably got kicked off before I quit.
Like a mutual deal.
Yeah. Well, no, I got kicked off. I mean, I heard like they were just doing some team changes, and I wasn't like at the time, I guess, useful anymore. And then there's Mark had already, I think, left or was about to leave. Jason was going to leave, and the team was dissolving. And I got a New Deal. I moved in with Justin Gerard.
Oh,
off of Hate
in SF.
In SF.
Rad.
And then I was living up there with Justin. He took care of me and got me kind of hooked up with New Deal. And I don't know what the hell was going on in my brain. That was the whole rave scene at the time.
Yeah.
So I started to do all, you know, started
Ecstasy.
Getting into Ecstasy and going out with Javonte Turner and Keith Cochran and all these fools. And I don't mean like fools like that. You know what I mean?
No,
I was just, it was just, all of us were fools as far as I'm concerned, because we were just destroying ourselves and whatever. That was the party scene, and we were you know, experiencing all that. But I took those habits with me, you know, from SF. When I moved, I think back down to San Diego, I moved in with back in with Danny. So I was with Danny before, you know, Blind got on Blind, moved out, moved back, moved to LA. I think I spent a little bit of time in Venice with Dune, and then around like 94-ish, 95, I guess, moved back to San Diego. And all these were really short stints, like, you know, few months, and then I would move, and it was weird, almost like couch surfing. But then I kind of settled in Danny's house. I remember we went out, just to keep it short, Danny, Josh Swindell, myself, and a bunch of other heads went up to Mammoth, and I was with Ken Block. Josh had some LSD that he was giving to everyone, and I thought I was the professional like LSD guy, so I was like, took the initiative to take more than everyone else. So when everyone was taking, you know, Josh's thing, he would go around everyone. He'd be like, here, bro, like six of these are equivalent to one, bro. So just like, you know, just here you go. And I was like, cool, man, I'll take 30 of them because I was used to taking a lot at the time. So, and I took 33 or so hits of it. After I took it, I realized what I had done. I was like, okay, I got this stuff now in my system. It's funny because Jason Lee, we always had this running joke when I lived with him. He would be like, Jason was super paranoid about someone putting LSD in his food.
Yeah, I know guys like that.
Okay, so he's like, someone put your LSD in and you're going to have a panic attack and die. All those old thoughts kind of raced to my head now. And I was like, oh, dude, I just took 33 hits of LSD. So I chewed up the ball and I spit this wad of paper out, you know, of my hand. And I was like, well, it's too late then. And like 30 minutes later, I'm sitting there and it starts to like kind of like I can't really swallow. I catch a good swallow.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm not swallowing properly. And something is like, it just feels like it's some chemical. Like I'm not like, I'm not able to control my breathing well. And like, I kind of started having an anxiety attack. And then I told Danny of all people. I was like, dude, Danny, you know, like I'm, you know, like I need help. You know, it's interesting because as crazy as Danny was, you know, he was the one who was like sat down with me and he was like patting me on the back. Like, it's okay, bro. Like,
yeah,
helping me through it, you know, which was interesting, you know, nice to see that. Like, you know, I was very thankful that he was like supportive because, but then I had to go to the hospital. Well, so I wrote it out. Months later, I was with Christian Fletcher, Danny, at one of Christian Fletcher's like death metal gigs or whatever. I don't know how I found myself in all these situations, but I'm taking like a bunch of mushrooms now. And I remember that was the highest no comply I ever did. I remember doing like no complies on flat ground, like waist high on mushrooms. So I understand why Evan Smith is so like big on hallucinogenics. I don't blame him because it does help your skating if you get in the right mindset.
Yeah.
It's like, I can do anything. But I was with them and I took mushrooms and then all night long I was like, we're just normal. In the morning time, we went to watch Christian Fletcher's footage of his first kickflip on a surfboard.
Sick.
And so we were sitting back and I was just tripping. I was like, me, Danny, Christian, and some other dude in the room. I don't remember who the other guy was. And they're all passing some, you know, weed around, whatever. I took a hit of the bong. I don't know. Like, I just completely, everything transformed. Like, I became like, I was in like ultra paranoia.
Oh, shit.
I was like, these dudes are gnarly. I got to get out of here. I don't know why, like, I felt like that, but I was like, I don't feel good here. I got to go. And I bailed out and started walking through the streets of San Clemente. Long story short is I turned myself in. I got my stomach pumped. After all that, the doctor, what they told me was I had chemical hepatitis. So I had this thick yellow, like, thrush growing on my tongue. And I had what's called a systemic candida or systemic fungal infection in my whole body. So when I had the mushrooms, it activated the yeast systemically in my blood. So when I took the mushrooms, it aggravated and, you know, I basically started to like have anxiety because I was vitamin deficient and I was eating poorly. I was just not taking care of myself.
Sure.
So whatever. When I went to Europe a year after those two scenarios is when, you know, skating all day long and the fatigue and not sleeping well. And
who are you with in Europe?
I was with New Deal. I was with Neil Hendricks, Tuss Pappas. Tuss was on Mad Circle.
Ah, were you guys going to like Munster and all the?
We were going contests? To Munster, and we were doing demos as well.
Okay.
Okay, so I'll paint a really short picture of what happened. I bought a tarot book when I was over there.
Uh huh.
Okay, so I started flipping through tarot. This is before I became Muslim and I went on my own kind of spiritual journey. Mm. So, in short, I read this tarot book and I was like, I was already a tripper in my own brain because I was already, you know, used to like going inside myself and thinking too much. So I bought this tarot book and I started reading all about all the numbers and I started making all these weird connections and basically just freaking myself out. And then ironically, I always was really paranoid about what's that thing where you're scared of getting a disease?
Hypochondriac.
So I was a hypochondriac as well at the time.
Okay.
Okay. I was scared I had AIDS.
Oh.
Okay. That was like the thing then. I was like, I have AIDS. And Jason was the same way. Jay Lee was the same way. And so when I was in Europe, I was like, that started to worry me more and more. Like, I have AIDS. I have AIDS. I have AIDS. I have AIDS. And the crazy thing is there's a graffiti artist in Germany at the time called HIV.
Whoa.
So I'm freaking seeing everywhere HIV. And this is reinforcing the freaking craziness.
Yeah.
That happened for about a week or two in the tour, where when I got to Munster, I'm starting to see HIV everywhere. And I'm like, okay, this is something, like someone's trying to tell me something, like what the hell is happening? And this, I'm started, and then the tarot book and the numbers, and I'm like, ah. And then what happened is I'm in a gas station at like 11:30 at night, and all the dudes from the industry are there, like going to the only gas station that was close to the hotel to get drinks and whatnot. And I went there too. I was already losing it.
Uh-huh.
People already knew I was like,
you're struggling.
Jordan's like going through something. Like,
yeah.
But we didn't have proper handlers then, I guess, if you want to call it, like people to help us.
Like a team manager.
Yeah, our team. I mean, we did, but we didn't. It was just kind of like, whatever, yeah. Like, or maybe I just slipped out away from the team manager and he didn't know. But then I'm sitting in the gas station and some random dude comes up. It's a German guy who has a scar across his neck. He spoke in German to me, and something told me, I was like, okay, I'm just going to go with this guy and like see where he's going to, what we're going to do. And then like, I don't know what he thought, like if I was like a lost kid or whatever.
Yeah.
And I was like, it's 17, 18 years old, or I don't know what he thought, but I got on the back of the bike with him and went to some squat house, got there and met some other dude with a scar from his throat all the way down to his belly button.
Oh.
So the first dude had a scar across his neck, the second guy had a, you know, like he had open heart surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a girl with a golden sun medallion. It's all this trippy stuff. And this is a squat house like in the middle of Germany, and I stayed there for a couple of days and just was like doing all this trippy stuff, nothing sexual or anything.
Yeah,
it was just a weird like trippy thing, you know. And then I left there, and then I went on the trains in Germany and rode into the kind of the wilderness on the train, got off, and then eventually the German police brought me back to the hotel. A few days later, I had to go home on the way back to Newark, New Jersey. So on the plane, I'm with Tuss Pappas and Neil, of all people. And I'm like, I have to solve the JFK case. Okay, like I'm put here to solve JFK, and I know that JFK is a conspiracy.
The grassy knoll.
And yeah, and I was like, I'm gonna solve it. And I was looking at briefcases around the plane. I was like, that's the briefcase right there that has the documents in it. So I guess I was going and like grabbing people's briefcases on the plane. And I was totally gone, right? I mean, you could call it whatever, like manic depression or.
But were you on any
I wasn't
drugs?
On anything.
Oh, really?
I wasn't on, that's the thing, I wasn't on anything. It was purely like manic depression, bipolar, grandiose like thinking like that just escalated. So when I got off the plane, which I thought, by the way, when I got off, I was at Never Neverland Ranch with Michael Jackson.
Wow.
There was 40 police officers waiting there for me.
Oh, for grabbing the people's briefcase?
For basically, and they're like, hey, what's up, buddy? Like, how you doing? I was like, I'm good, guys. Like, you guys are like, and I was like, yeah, you guys are my bodyguards. Like, you're here to receive me.
Where's Michael Jackson at?
Yeah, like, where's Michael? Like, all right. Like, yeah, come on, no worries. And then they put me in like a, the Funny Farm bus and strapped me down. That was 1994. Which the same day, ironically, was Woodstock. So I was looking at the monitor, TV monitor, when I got to the psychiatric hospital of all these people partying at Woodstock. And I was like, they're celebrating my my this and that. So it was all this really weird. So I'm just taking you into a mind of the craziness. So I was totally gone. I'm trying to give some context to how wacky and zany it was, but the little things like going and almost getting in a fight with Mike V on the course and other things like streaking. I think I was streaking around there too, and like there's a lot of problems, you know,
in Europe.
Yeah, I think the most troubling thing of the whole thing is like it's very rare that I found anyone in the industry though that had the decency to like come up to me during that time and really like, or after that time for that matter, and have like a genuine care and concern, like, hey, are you okay? Like, is there anything I can do? Like, you went through this, like, I understand, like, I haven't gone through it, but I know someone who has. Whatever, you know, just trying to like, you know, you give yourself to this, into an industry, you know, you give yourself to a team, and you exert your blood, sweat, and tears for them. You know, and the least you have is a common decency to like inquire, you know, about the welfare of someone and try to help them. You know, that was, I think, the most hurtful part is like,
sure.
In the back of my own mind, I was like, man, people don't really care too much. It's kind of jacked up. And then when I got off, I got and spent 30 days in a Marlboro Psychiatric Institute. In New Jersey. And Marlboro, ironically or coincidentally, whatever you want to call it, got shut down for like malpractice, like bad practice 2 years later.
Right.
After I left there, because if you look up Marlboro Institute or Marlboro Psychiatric Hospital, it's like this was a spooky place. It was a sanitarium, basically, where they would like do some pretty crooked things.
I feel like if your mind's kind of weak and then they put you in a psychiatric, like all I can think of is how anxiety I would have. Like, I'm never getting out of here. People think I'm crazy. Like, and it would escalate. Like, did it, you know, intensify everything or?
No. The weird thing is that probably, I don't know. It was weird. Like I was in the moment is all I could say. Like I was so far gone. There were times where I wanted to get out, but I think I was more of just like, I was still not stable. So I was towards the end when the medication started to work, per se, whatever that means. Getting off medication, by the way, the psychotropic drugs, when I finally got off them, you know, this is like years later, this is like probably like 10, I mean, 12 years ago. It was getting off. It was like taking a piece of a t-shirt and dragging it through a thorn bush was how it literally felt getting off psychotropic drugs. It was a pull that of such like rely, like you relied so much on it. And I think that that's why most people don't get off psychiatric drugs. Like once they start, like the heavy ones, like Depakote, Zyprexa, you know, they target a certain part of your neurosystem and they kind of grab you. It was no joke.
Wow. Yeah. Whew, that's heavy.
Yeah. But I think what it was, what got me through is that I was still crazy, but I was just good. I was acting like I wasn't crazy. Like I figured out like, okay, they're going to interview me. I have to play it straight.
Yeah.
Because they're going to ask me some key questions. Do you want to hurt yourself? No. Do you want to hurt anyone else? No. You know, what day is it? So I'd have to find out what day it was. Uh-huh. And then, you know, just basics, you know?
Yeah.
And when they do these stupid audits, you know, and you're able to pass that, then based on that, you're quote unquote okay. But I was not okay at all. I was still very, 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 very troubled. but I got out of there. And I had other episodes after that until I finally, you know, figured out, you know, what the deal was.
Uh-huh.
And what the deal was, a lot of it was, believe it or not, was dietary related. There's studies now that prove that there's a direct link between the stomach health of a person and their neurological state.
You mentioned getting off the medication was really like gnarly, but do you think the process was beneficial? Would you recommend that, or would you say like that whole part was...
Well, I recommend one thing. If someone is really, really, really off the rocker,
uh-huh,
they need to be, number one, like contained.
Yeah.
And controlled. That's where medication works best.
Uh-huh.
It's never like the goal is never to try to keep someone on medication. The goal is to heal that deeper issue inside them so they don't rely on medication.
Sure.
But the medication is just a Band-Aid at the end of the day.
Okay.
But
right.
But if someone is, say, you know, running down the street naked and they're saying that they're Jesus Christ, and these are the common like episodes, right?
Uh-huh.
Someone claims to be Jesus, someone's running around naked. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so those type of situations, they should be contained and controlled. Person should get sedated so that they can then get some therapy and come off gradually.
Okay.
The medication.
So then after that, you mentioned getting into Muslim.
I embraced Islam. Yeah. Well, so I saw the movie Malcolm X. Part of like the experience, like of what I went through, was all, I guess, pieces to making me look at my life and kind of ask some simple questions. I don't know. I just got tired of not being in control of myself. And I got tired of... See, for me, it wasn't ever about like religion.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I was never a religious person. Actually, I was very adverse to religion. I wasn't into it. And I made fun of it. My grandmother always told me about, you know, yeah, there's a creator. You should do the right thing. It was basic, you know, golden rules.
Sure.
That she would instill in me. I saw the movie Malcolm X when I was already really, really just kind of coming out of my jacked up phase. And I saw that he was able to reform himself and become a better person from a complete criminal. He was able to make this transformation. And I thought that was really inspiring. And I wanted that for myself somewhat. Even if I wasn't going to like make it all the way, I wanted to at least try to be a righteous person.
Uh-huh.
I knew I was going to screw up and I would continue, and still to this day. But at least I was in the process of trying to... do the right thing. And so Islam was a consequence of that, you know. Cat Stevens has been Muslim since probably the early 80s.
Right.
His name is Yusuf Islam now, but when Cat was in his record producer's house in Hollywood, he went out to the ocean and went swimming. And what happened is he got caught in the tide and got literally swept out to sea. Couldn't get back in. And he just started to panic. And there was no lifeguard at the time. And he was the only one there. You know, he said, you know, oh God, you know, if you save me, I'll change my life, you know. Nowadays, unfortunately, like when you talk about religion and religion in general is a very, very taboo subject. I understand how, because of my own upbringing, because of my background, I understand why people have an adversity.
Sure.
Towards religion, or to talk about religion, or to hear, have to be preached to about religion. So I don't, you know, I don't preach to people. If someone asks me, I'll answer the, you know, what's required. You know, Butch Sturbins, of all people, messaged me.
Uh-huh.
You know, from, you remember Butch?
Yeah.
From the Z-Boys.
Yeah, yeah.
But he messaged me. I'll show you. And I answered his question, you know. Yeah, he's like, and so the thing is, like, with all due respect to my like, Christian brothers, like, yeah, I don't take the same approach. Like, I don't overtly, like, go and proselytize.
Right.
He messaged me and was like, you know, instead of saying like, bro, like, how you been? Haven't talked to you in a long time. He sent me the Malcolm X post I posted, and I posted this post here, and I was like, hand the presidency to a man like Malcolm and watch things get, you know, changed.
Uh-huh.
Anyone who knows Malcolm would agree that he was a very, very great man. And then Butch says he didn't like white people.
Wow.
Okay, so it's like, okay. I mean, first of all, that's to be argued. And there was a time where he had spoken about a lot of things about, you know, that the white man was doing, not white people in general, but the people. There was something called slavery and civil rights movement in America. There's things that actually happened that would warrant a black person to have some, especially during, you know, in the 1950s and 60s. But it was interesting. I was just like, you know, towards the end of his life, he corrected that. I just answered him nicely. And then he said, what do you think about Jesus and Christianity? And so I'm like, Okay, and I answered him, but I think people in general, what I'm getting at is like the ability to really understand and listen to each other has become more and more, it's become more and more harder. At the end of the day, people don't want to hear what you have to say. They want to watch what you're freaking doing. Mm-hmm. They're going to look at your actions.
In today's society, it just seems like people are so quick to judge and to look at somebody's downfall as their rise for some reason.
Sure.
You know, it's kind of like, haha, you blew it. Somehow I feel better.
You're dealing with a media culture that thrives off of other people's dirty laundry, of airing other people's dirty laundry.
Right.
I mean, the news is a very culture of Hollywood, and news is hell-bent on exposing the wrongs of anyone they can. Ironically, the in more cases than not, the producers and the owners of those media houses are more corrupt than the stories that they're covering.
Right.
But you never hear about them because they own the media house.
They have the power. Exactly. How does this not get worse? How does it get better?
More things of what you're doing, you know, like seeking out like those conversations at whatever level they are. I think like even in the small impact that they make, like, you know, getting the right people and having the right conversations to expand that awareness of what's happening. Hollywood is probably the worst thing that's happened to culture as we know it. And there's a documentary called Hollywoodism that I encourage everyone to watch.
Yeah.
It's on YouTube.
Okay.
And it will give you kind of the breakdown of where, how we've arrived here, where we're at today. I do have to go to the bathroom really bad.
Okay.
I'm just going to go real quick.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Yeah, let's take a little break.
No worries.
Yeah. Okay, while he's peeing, let's get another one of our first impressions with Tim McKenney.
First impressions with Tim McKenney. There was only one, and it was in Tampa. I believe we just were skating down the streets. It was in a time of less spoken words. Don't think he said anything, and if he did, it was under his breath. But the sense of calmness transferred into me. He was already spiritually conscious, while we all seemed lost. The machine might have got to him early. I was just stoked to be there to tell you the truth. Who don't remember the how to put on a condom board? All love, kid. It's gonna be a good one.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Yeah, I was just trying
some
to...
heavy...
That was some heavy shit. Let's go with the lighter shit.
Whoa, man. Okay.
Hey, so the kids. What are the kids doing these days? You have a kid?
I have four. Two boys, two girls.
What age span?
My two boys, 10 and 5. And my two girls are 2 and 10 months.
Oh, damn.
Yeah. 2 years
Got
old.
Got a little baby one.
It's beautifully crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're living in the Fremont area?
I live in Union City.
Union City. You liking it?
I like it, yeah.
You've been there for a while, right?
I've been here for about 10 years.
And you're teaching the kids at the skate park. You got like your own little academy?
Yeah, we do skateboard recreation programs. So we partner with the cities, and we also do after school programming. So we have about 8 locations throughout the Bay Area. Yeah.
Oh, cool. How many? And there's, you're saying that this one, there's like 30.
We have like a total of eight programs. So we have after schools as well. So it's crazy. I mean, this summer so far, we've had about 630 enrollments.
Damn.
Yeah. So it's like 40% of them roughly are brand new to skateboarding. So it's kind of cool. Like we have a full curriculum, like we take them through like a series of exercises, like skill exercises.
Uh-huh.
They earn like little wristbands, like colored wristbands, like karate bands.
Oh, okay.
So they'll be like, you know, get
like
the green
a blue
band.
Belt.
Green. Yeah, blue belt, and just wristbands.
How cool. That's
and
a good
so
idea.
So it gives them something to strive for and work at. And we needed to have some kind of way for parents to understand that we're actually, you know, your kids are learning something.
Sure. They get stoked on it. Yeah. Mommy, I'm yellow now.
Totally.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just, it's a fun way to quantify or kind of whatever you want to call it, measure their progress.
So does that have you skating a lot personally?
Lately, I haven't been skating as much as I'd like to. I've just, not because of that, just busy with like family stuff.
Uh-huh.
The kids. And so I'm skating, but I'm not like skating.
Okay.
Right now, so we're dissolving the whole academy. Like, we're going to get rid of the Jordan Richter Skateboard Academy. We're starting a new programming kind of brand, which is called Enter.
Oh.
It's called ENTER. So Enter Skateboarding.
Uh-huh.
So it's strictly to promote skateboarding.
Oh, so that's really cool.
Yeah, so we're working on that.
What would you say the percentage is of female to male for the kids that are doing this stuff these days?
Honest estimation, probably be like 3 out of every 10.
Our girls. Oh, I was just in Austin and I was talking to the skate shop, Elias. He owns No Comply out there, and he was talking about how, like, what have you noticed in skateboarding lately that's kind of cool or whatever? And he was like, absolutely, the growth of female skaters has been really, like, in your face. Like, it's really growing. And
yeah,
and that's cool to see.
Yeah.
Who are some of the old skaters that you're still in contact with, that, like, you're friends with and stuff, that do you talk to anybody on, like, kind of a regular basis?
Yeah, I'm in touch with Brian Ridgway a lot.
Oh.
I don't know if you know Ridgway.
Yeah.
So we're in contact almost sometimes every week, but then we'll go a while without it. I mean, Peter, obviously, like, it's a text message away, but we don't hang as much as we should, but uh-huh. But Pete, and then, like, Greg Witt.
Oh, yeah.
I'm in touch with him a lot.
Do you ever go down to Berkeley vert ramp?
I do, but not lately. I haven't gone in a long time, but I was riding there. I need to get back riding.
That's a good ramp.
Yeah. It is.
It's built well, and it's cool.
You've been riding there too, right?
Yeah, me and Jason will go there, and then sometimes Max comes out, and
yeah,
it's pretty rad, actually. Like, I'm not a vert skater necessarily, but I'm learning.
Some footage of you.
Well, when you film with Jason, it's very true that he picks and chooses how long he's going to skate for. So while he's doing his whole method, I'm down to skate. And then when he's ready, I'll grab the camera, but I don't necessarily think I have my vert legs yet, but it definitely helped, like, skating. And Rob Welsh is there, and he'll skate, and so it's kind of like fun.
He seems like a cool guy. I don't think I've met Rob.
Yeah, he's great. You would love him. He's funny, and he's really into, like, learning the vert stuff too. And it's kind of like surfing for me, where I can go out and have a blast and suck.
I've been doing this for 7 years with the skateboarding programs here.
Mm-hmm.
At first, it was a way for me to, like, still be in the industry and, I mean, still be around skateboarding and not have to work on 9 to 5.
Yep.
And then it turned into, like, saw the community response and saw, like, the need for, like, sounds corny or whatever, but, like, organized, like, structured programming, because the reality is, like, cities and parents and schools, like, if we don't get in front of them and help them understand, if we don't create a reason for them, then they're just going to go default to, like, basketball and football. And I think now it's coming to a point where the statistically traditional sports are taking a dip.
Yeah, that's what it seems like.
Kids are losing interest. As things become more international and as more immigrants come, there's more of a disconnection towards, or I should say, disinterest in some of the more traditional sports, just because it's harder for them to kind of get involved and sync up with their teammates and compete and be competitive or whatever. So skateboarding is now becoming, like, the go-to for keeping active and challenging a child, with, you know, which is cool.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, individuality is great. I would just warn you kids that if you're too much of an individual, it can come back to bite you in the ass. You know?
I'm just curious, like, what do you do with Thrasher now?
I've been the lead at the web department for many years since it wasn't a big deal. And then it turned into a big deal. And then we got more of a team. So it's funny, because at one time I was doing like 5 websites. So now I'm part of a team that does one. So it's interesting to look at things like that, right? Mostly I'm just trying to get out and film. I'll go to events, cover those. I help a lot of people with edits. Like, people will go film stuff, but they don't really know how to edit. They'll send me the footage and I'll edit it. I encourage people to hit me up when they come to town, because it's always great to, like, hey, let's go skate first and foremost, obviously. But on top of that, like, yeah, maybe we can film something and, sure, you know, maybe I can get a photographer out there and you can be in the mag.
You know, Jake was always really supportive of me, which was interesting.
Oh, really? Yeah, you had a good relationship with him?
Yeah, it was never bad. It was, Jake has always been obviously Jake, but
yeah,
but he was one of the few that would, like, I think there was one instance where it was like a video premiere or whatever, and someone like made fun of, people like to make fun of me, I guess.
Huh.
That's cool. And Jake was like, what are you doing, man? Like, he's like, what are you making fun of, dude? You can't do like a nollie shuffle fakie, bro, or something like that, over chest high.
Yeah.
Anyways, he always was like very, stuck up for me.
That's cool.
He was a cool guy like that.
Yeah, I miss Jake.
Regardless of what people, their ideas about him, he was dedicated to skateboarding. And
yeah, 100%. It's pretty gnarly going into work every day and just seeing his office, because I work right next door to his office. And a lot
of
his
office still there?
Yeah, the office will always be there. But I mean, some of his stuff is still there. I would say a lot of his stuff is still there, yeah. There's a rack of clothes. There's, like, his jacket that he wore. You know, it's kind of like, in a weird way, it's kind of like, have you ever been to Bodie or one of those ghost towns? It's kind of like that, where, like, the people got up and just left everything, and it's still like it is. Like, the CDs are still there, his scribbling, or, like, the things on the wall that he's tacked.
I think it'd be cool to preserve that and just make it, like, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to say a museum is not the right word, but
right,
a memorial that's just kind of stays intact.
Do you have any tips for, like, just trying to keep it positive in general? Like,
I'll take some from someone.
Yeah.
One of the things that's helped me a lot, especially, like, get through some of the hard times and the challenges, and I still have to always remind myself, but, you know, selecting the right people, like the right friends, is freaking crucial. You know, you really do become the people you're around, the people you surround yourself with. Finding people who are going to be a positive impact. I feel like we need that more than ever, like, to seek out the right people to surround ourselves with. See, that's just aligning with the right people, giving time to yourself, like when you feel down or you feel depressed or you're going through something, like, it's okay to, like, stop whatever you're doing and go to the beach. And break away,
yeah.
You know,
get a little me time. You know,
that me time, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know, meditate or whatever the hell, you know. It works.
Right.
You know what I was doing is and I would recommend this to try it. But a lot. What has been the most, I think, life changing for me? It has probably been fasting.
Oh.
I mean, we fast as Muslims in Ramadan.
Like, for days.
We fast for 30 days.
Whoa.
But we eat at sundown. But if someone doesn't want to do that, I mean, you don't necessarily have to do that. So if someone is from another faith or another practice, or, you know, don't necessarily have to be a religion, you can start, you know, when you wake up in the morning, just try to get as far as you can. Yeah, and you become accustomed to, like, your stomach gets smaller and you become accustomed to longer periods of time without food. And it engenders a certain type of humility. When you're hungry, right, you become humble. You'll be agitated at first, but the more you practice it, then it'll start breaking you down, and you become more humble and you become more self-reflective. So fasting sort of quiets or cools that fire down so that you can have some more clarity. The best sessions I've ever had was when I was fasting.
Oh.
I did a maple syrup fast. And Cab knows about the maple syrup fast. They always, I think Cab and Christian were doing it too for a while, but it's water, lemon, maple syrup, and cayenne pepper.
Cayenne, yeah.
I did that for 40 days.
Whoa.
Straight with only that.
Did you lose weight?
I lost a lot of weight. I went down to like 145, 147.
Wow.
But I learned kickflip nose wheelies in the pool then, in Cunningham.
No way.
Out of the shallow into the deep. And that was, I did that on the fast because of the clarity and the energy that I had.
You know, I hang out with Jason, Jesse a lot. Name drop there. But he just started doing transcendental meditation.
You,
yeah, he's the best. No matter what anybody else says or thinks.
He's a great guy. He's a good person.
He started doing the transcendental meditation, and he said that it is so powerful in helping him, like, with a lot of the struggles he's going through. So I've been looking into that, but that stuff's hard for me. I start shaking and shit when I try to meditate, like, officially meditate.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
It's been fucking awesome. Really a privilege.
I'm privileged, man. Thank you for your time and for
giving you. When I started this whole thing, I never envisioned that I'd be down here talking to you. And so it's an honor for me. Like, really cool. It's good shooting the shit.
Likewise.
But yeah, man, I've been a fucking big fan of yours forever. And I continue to be. I never was the FF Vert guy. I always enjoyed it, and I think most people do, too. They're just closet Vert lovers. So that's all we got today. We'll be back next Tuesday, as we are every Tuesday. Thank you so much, Jordan. And any last words?
Spread the love. Thank you, Schmitty, and thank you for having me. And I just, the last words would be find out who individuals are by reaching out and actually trying to understand the person by actually spending time with them, if possible. Yeah.
All right. And we out. Peace.
Peace.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Talkin' Schmidt. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Anchor, Spotify, or anywhere you get your podcasts. When you subscribe, you'll get notifications every Tuesday of new episodes the minute they become available. Also, please leave reviews and a 5-star rating. It's the best way to help the show grow up them charts. All the episodes will always remain free to my listeners, but if you'd like to help support the show, you can do so at our website, TalkinSchmidt.com, where you can pick up some merchandise like stickers, beanies, hats, possibly even a t-shirt. The website has an entire archive of the episodes with extra photos and sometimes even video. If you have personal pics of our Talkin' Schmidt guests, please send them to me at epicallytrife@yahoo.com, and maybe your photo will end up on the site, or better yet, on Talkin' Schmidt's Instagram account. All interviews are conducted, edited, and produced by me, Schmitty. The intro music is Mary's Cross by the band Nature, and a special shout-out goes to my executive director, Cheryl Camisa.
Shout-out.
Love it!
Until next week, this is Talkin' Schmidt, where the Rolodex is deep, but the conversation is deeper.
Talkin' Schmidt. Talkin' Schmidt. Talkin' Schmidt.